Weedamu, page 16. Later. The flies here at the oceanside come in great swarms, so Mother has smeared us all with ointment made from that red juice of the blue root plant that she gathers every spring. Now we look very ruddy, but the flies are avoiding us. The next day. This afternoon, while the other children here at the encampment were gathering rocks and driftwood and seaweed for the big cooking pit on the beach, Wutunikanusk and I, page 17, slipped away into the forest that borders the shore so closely here. This peninsula is thick-wooded, right down to where the narrow line of beach and pebbles begins, and I could hear a squirrel scolding. Chatter, we call him in our tongue, and this one has much to say for himself. I chased him just for the fun of hearing him scold. I knew there would be a clam bake tonight, and no one would be wanting stew made from any stringy squirrel. Besides, I had not carried my bow with me. To speak the truth, Wutanukuski did not exactly slip away with me. She was just tagging along behind, as usual, on her short legs. My own legs are strong and getting scarily long. It seems to me, ever since I started my monthly cycle this past summer. It was a sunny early autumn afternoon as I ran after the squirrel, the sight of the leaves just beginning to turn gold and scarlet and orange against gray rock ledges, and the bright blue sky made my chest ache somehow, just because it was all so beautiful. It is strange that even though I do not like my little sister following me around all the time, she cannot bear to be where I am not. Today I almost outran her in these strange woods, but I waited until she caught up. She whispered that we should not go far from Massasoit's village. Wutanuskiuski is always frightened. Those English, page 18, coatmen will kidnap her if we get too far away from our people. She is only 2 years younger than me, and I keep telling her she ought to stand tall and be braver. I'm sorry to say that I called her Little Moss for Brains and Mouse Heart, but then I agreed to start back with her toward the encampment after all. To tell the truth, I was a little afraid myself in those woods so far from home, and as we began to retrace our steps, I realized that in our running we had left a trail as plain as if we had dragged a slain deer behind us. All at once, as we entered a clearing, we sensed at the same time there was something different about the forest. I pointed with my chin toward a nearby deadfall, and we stole over and crouched behind the loosely piled old branches. I remembered too late all my father's skulking lessons. Move with the motion of other things. Make noise only when there is some other sound to cover it. Now, two someones were coming. At least, I thought, they were probably not English, for they seemed to know all the same tricks we had been taught about moving quietly. Only if we listened closely, we could hear them talking, or taking, page 19, steps, whenever the light breeze blew and rattled the leaves. At last, two Indian boys appeared in the clearing. Though I had not seen them for more than a year, and they had grown much taller, I knew at once they must be Wamsutta and Metacom, Massasoit's sons. We watched as they squatted down to examine our tracks, and soon Wamsutta shrugged and got up to follow our back trail. But Metacom, the younger one, just kept scanning the ground, though he looked straight over at our brush pile and called in a low voice for his brother to come back. "They are right here," he said, and Wamsutta returned, grinning, and started toward us. At that, I sprang up and demanded to know how those two dared to follow us like sneaking wolves, but they did not have the courage to come up on two Pocasset women, face to face. Wamsutta smiled. "I am tall, but he is taller." He said he had seen no women, but that he and his brother had certainly heard two Pocasset little girls go crashing through the brush, making as much noise as a wounded moose. Metacom stood up. He said softly that he was very sorry if they had scared us, but after all, it was our own father who had sent them to find us. I glared at him and said that nothing had scared us. Page 20. Least of all, two sneaky Poconoket boys, Then I grabbed Wootanukauski by the arm, and we walked as swiftly as possible back toward the shore and our people. This time, my sister and I took care to snap no twigs, disturb no leaf. I did not deign to look behind, but I was sure those boys were grinning. In Wamsutta's case, I am certain he was smirking. I am sorry to say this, but I am not patient, and I do not like these boys. I am only sorry that I ran carelessly through the woods and gave them away to Trellis effortlessly. Later. I have a full belly and a full heart tonight. Tonight, I think, I might someday learn to be patient. The next day. They say that when Squant and her husband Moshop and their children lived among us, the two were so gigantic that for food they would just scoop up whales off the coast and broil them whole on the beach. It is sad, page 21, if Squant and her family did not get to enjoy clam bakes just because clams were too puny a food for those giant ones to eat. But who knows? Maybe their whale roasts were as much fun as our clam bakes. I know I ran off from the early part of those cooking pit preparations yesterday afternoon. But what a joy it was to get away from those two Pokanahoket boys and work with the other women and youngsters to cover the stones grown hot in the bonfire with armfuls of wet rockweed. I always loved to hear the squishy float bladders pop in the heat. On top of the seaweed, we piled layers of clams and fish with rockweed in between, and at last heaps of our sweet mother corn in her great skirt husks. Finally, we covered the whole pit over with yet more rockweed, and then we let the ocean-smelling steam-cook all this good food. When we raked open the pit, everything was ready. Golden corn, clams with their shells peeping open, and sweet-fleshed fish. Of course, Wamsutta and Metacom helped too, but I whispered to my sister, "We must not even look at them." My dear friend Cedar and her family arrived in camp by the time we began our feast. She has a wide grin, and I could recognize from 100 paces away. She and I sat side by side, though at first we hardly talked. We were so busy eating. We just smiled and nudged each other as we, page 22, chomped corn and fish and slurped down clams from their shells. Dribbles of juice made our arms and hands shiny and clammy-smelling. Afterwards, all of us young ones raced over to the silvery freshwater stream that runs out of the woods and across the beach and empties into the sea. There we washed up, because if you try to rinse off in the salt water, it just makes everything stickier. The tide was starting to come in, and we squatted down at the shoreline on slippery rocks and waited a little in the bay, which is no longer warm enough to swim in. Then we all walked up toward the great council fires, surrounded by Witus. We finished cleaning up the empty shells and corn cobs and joined our families in the circles around the central fire. As the evening grew cooler with an autumn edge to it, we snuggled down in our bearskin robes. There was dancing. Oh, the sound of the drums and the voices joining in the dear old songs of thanks and joy, and the dancers circling the fire, their faces lit up one by one as they moved past us. The storyteller began just as full darkness fell. This time, the one doing the telling, was the old woman who is a great-great-auntie of Cedar. Her name is Willow, but everybody just calls her Nugomis, or grandmother. Last night, the stories were about Squant and Moshop, page 23, and their children. We learned how Squant's eyes became square. The next night, Cedar's family camp at Motop. Tonight, I am sleeping with Cedar and her family. She and I watched the dancing for a while, and then crept over here into our bearskins and whispered and giggled until very late. Wootanukauski tagged along, of course. When we told Cedar about those boys following us into the forest, she laughed, and then said thoughtfully, she was not sure it was such a bad thing to be followed by boys like them. Well, they are her cousins, and she really likes them. All the while we talked, we could hear the crackle and roar of the great council fire, and our elders singing. But now, even Cedar is fast asleep, and so I can have my thinking time. Here is how it was last night. Listen, the storyteller began, as she always must. Here is something about Moshope and Squant. Oh, good, we all said loudly together, as we always do to encourage her. I lay on my tummy between Utanukuski and Cedar, with my chin on my hands. Page 24. Next to my sister, my mother sat cross-legged on a bearskin, nursing Snowbird. In the silence between the parts of the story, we could hear Snowbird's lips smacking as she suckled our mother's rich milk. Since we have been here at Montaupe, our baby sister seems stronger. My auntie Whitefrost says that when our people come together to parley and dance and listen to the stories and the singing, it brings us all better health. Now those two, Moshop and Squant, were very much larger than ordinary folks, the storyteller went on. And when our people first came upon them on the easternmost shores of this land, beside the Sunrise Ocean, those two giant ones were very generous. Moshop shared with us the whales he fished us and broiled on the beaches. And here, as I listened to Nugumis, I imagined what she was telling, and in the darkness I traced with my finger the shape of a whale in the sand. Moshop told us when to plant corn, and he warned us when the big storms were coming. The people thanked Moshop with heaping baskets of tobacco, and to this day his pipe smoke makes the fog. When he knocked the ashes out of his giant pipe, a pipe with a stem far longer than the tallest pine, he made the islands we call Nantusket, far off among the waves. Then he threw huge rocks into the ocean to give him stepping stones from whence he might fish, and many a Coatman's ship has run aground there at that place the English call the Devil's Bridge. Countless are the tales of Moshop, but tonight I will speak of Squant, his wife, who watches over our girls and women, and why it is that she looks as she does. Once Squant was so beautiful that all women were jealous of her, and all men, except Moshop, were angry because they could not have her for themselves. One late summer day, she fell asleep in a sandy hollow in the dunes after picking beech plums. A bad-hearted man decided that if he could not have her, he would make her so that no one ever would want her. He stole upon her with the shell of a razor clam in his hand, and quick as you can blink, he slit her eyelids, snick, 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 so that her beautiful green eyes became square-shaped when she opened them. She woke with a cry, wiping the blood from her lovely cheeks. By the time people came to help, it was too late to catch the man who had fled down the beach and flung the clamshell back into the ocean. Ever since, Squant has worn her long black hair, brushed forward over her face to hide her strange eyes. And yet, the few, page 26, who have come across her on the dunes at twilight and seen her part her heavy hair and stare at them, swear she is still awesomely beautiful, square eyes and all. The next day. Tonight, Cedar came to spend the night in our camp. Lying there in the dark, we held hands and tried to remember exactly Nugumis's words about Squant, repeating the story over and over to each other, so some day we shall be able to tell it properly ourselves. Cedar forgot it was a razor clam the bad man used on Squant's poor eyelids. She said he used a flint knife, but Wutaniukuski and I both remembered better. I thought my little sister had been sound asleep during the storytelling, but it seemed she was listening all the time. When Cedar said the part about the knife, Wutaniukuski bounced up right out of her bearskin and cried, "No, no, it was a clamshell, was it not, Weetamoo?" "Yes," I told her. "Hush." I can still see in my mind's eyes Squant waking up on the beach with her poor cut eye and the bad man running down the beach and tossing that bloody clamshell off into the shallows. Page 27. I wonder, shall I ever meet Squant's square-eyed beauty face to face? The next day. Tomorrow is our last full day at Montaupe. There has been feasting and dancing and storytelling every night, and the elders talk all during the days. We know, Cedar and I, from listening at the councils where our elders pass the pipe and speak of troubles, that there is much talk among them of the Copemen's cattle and pigs. The Copemen set their animals free every day to roam outside their stout pens and stockades. Then these creatures happily trample our fields. The pigs root up our corn and their wet, snuffly snouts, and we children cannot scare them away so easily as we do the crows just by waving our arms and yelling. What is more, the Copemen's cattle roam easily over the wild, grassy meadows we have carefully cleared for Ahtoks, the deer, to browse in. Once the deer would come gratefully to graze in the meadows we prepared for them, and in turn they easily gave up their lives to us so that our people might have meat during the winter. Now the great clumsy mooing beasts muddy these open places and crop 28. All the tender grass, and the deer hide back in the woods. They have become much harder to hunt. Massasoit shakes his head and says he has tried to tell the Copemen to keep their beasts to home, but they say it is we who should take the trouble to build stout fences around all our fields, we who fence in no living thing, not plants or animals either. My father takes the pipe from Massasoit and smiles. I know what that smile means, for I have seen it many times. It means, I told you so. Later this day. O Squant, grant me patience, but even more, grant me skill. This afternoon, as we youngsters were gathering rockweed to spread over the beachside cooking pits for our final feasts, those boys, Wamsutta and Metacom, edged near me and my sister Wamsutta. She leaned closer to me and whispered. He had heard rumors that a certain little Pocoset girl could shoot an arrow straighter than any youngster. He said that he did not believe a word of it. But if I'd meet him tomorrow, at dawn, in that same clearing, where he and Metacom discovered us cowering. Cowering? That was the word he used. Page 29. Then we could test the truth of the matter. He said this all with such a grin it made me angry, and I threw a handful of sopping rockweed right into his face. Wootanukanooski and Annie gasped, but Cedar only laughed. While Wamsutta sputtered and wiped the strands of seaweed from his eyes, I said he could count on seeing us, Pocoset women, there. Suddenly, his younger brother Metacom stepped forward and laid one hand on my arm and his other on Wamsutta's. He said he would settle the matter with marksmanship, not harsh words, and flung seaweed. Then he added that each of us should think of what we might offer as a gift should the other person win the match. I am almost certain I shall win, but if I do not, I believe I will present Wamsutta with a pot full of biting black butterflies. I shall enjoy seeing the expression on his face. The next day. Right now I am riding the swells, headed back home in our dugout canoe, clutching a wriggling puppy to my belly. I am happy to say I won the archery contest. Page 30. I want to remember the way it was. When we got to the clearing where we were to meet, the boys were already there, and they had brought some of their friends as well as their little sister Amy. She was carrying their baby brother, Sunkonoowu. As always, when I look at other little ones a snowbird's age, I feel a tug at my heart when I see how much more robust they seem than she. But I had little time to dwell on that thought. Wootanukanooski pulled up my arm as I began to stride straight out into the clearing. She shoved a rolled-up belt she had woven into the palm of my left hand and tucked my fingers about it. "Remember, you should have something to give him, whether you win or lose," she whispered. And I realized that was true. I just had not thought about it. I had been so busy practicing archery, even last night in my dreams. "You keep it," I whispered back, "until this is over." She nodded and slipped away to stand with Cedar and Metacom, and Amy and the others who had come to watch. Wootanukanooski and I were made to bring along seal and gull this morning, so my poor sister had her hands full with those twins. Finally, she put them to building little weetas out of twigs, and they settled down. Wamsutta was checking the string on his full-sized bow of hickory, more than 5 feet long. I clutched my smaller bow, page 31, the one Father made especially for me. I knew his bigger bow meant Wamsutta would surely have a longer range, but I also knew I had a good eye and a steady hand. Wamsutta's face was lit by the ruddy autumn dawn light. He looked up and pointed to a circle he had already drawn with dark pokeberry juice on the smooth trunk of a big birch about 30 paces away. He proposed we see who could come closer to the center of the circle, the most often using 5 arrows apiece. I agreed, and notched my first arrow to my bow. I looked across the clearing at the target until somehow, as sometimes happens when you are shooting well, my arms and my eyes and the arrow in the circle all seemed to come together. Then I let fly, knowing even before the arrow stood shuddering in the heart of the bark that my aim would be true. Wamsutta's bowstring broke on his very first shot and unnerved him so much that he hit the target only 2 times and I 4. Now we are coming into a stretch of very choppy waters, so I will stop thinking for a while.